From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the U.S. vice president flies to Ukraine. South Korea's president slams the crew of a capsized ferry. Relatives of the victims of a downed Malaysian aircraft are still demanding answers about the accident. And the U.N. mission in South Sudan accuses rebels of killing hundreds of civilians. All this and more just ahead. I'm Dave DeForest. U.S. Vice President Joe Biden has arrived in Kiev for talks with Ukraine's acting president and prime minister. His visit comes as the situation in eastern Ukraine remains tense despite an agreement aimed at easing the crisis. White House officials say Biden will discuss the international community's efforts to help Ukraine move forward on constitutional reform, as well as the presidential election scheduled for May 25th. U.S. President Barack Obama's trip to Asia this week comes as concerns about China's territorial ambitions are growing in the region. Those concerns have been compounded by Russia's recent actions in Ukraine and the possibility that Chinese strategists might be looking to Crimea as a model for its territorial disputes with its neighbors. VOA's Bill Ide has more from Beijing.
Ukraine may seem far removed from events unfolding in one of the world's most dynamic regions, a key driver of the global economy. But it is clearly on the minds of U.S. officials. Speaking at a security conference in Indonesia last month, Admiral Harry Harris, commander of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, talked about the need for all countries in the region to work to avoid a Crimea-type situation in the Pacific. Earlier in April, Daniel Russell, Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia and Pacific Affairs, told U.S. lawmakers that sanctions the U.S. and European Union placed on Russia should have a chilling effect on anyone in China who might be thinking about using Crimea as a model. He also said that sanctions put pressure on China to show it is committed to peaceful resolution of its disputes in the region. Over the past 2 years, China has put increasing pressure on Japan in a dispute over islands in the East China Sea. It has sent Coast Guard patrols and drones to assert its claims. Late last year, it unilaterally announced an air defense identification zone, which includes the islands. Jean-Pierre Cabestan, a political scientist at Hong Kong Baptist University, says there is clearly a temptation for Beijing to try and alter the status quo. But, he adds, there are big differences between China's disputes in Asia and what has happened on the Crimean Peninsula.
For one thing, Japan is a U.S. ally. There is a security treaty between Japan and the U.S. which compelled the U.S. to intervene, and China knows it. I think even more so today, because the U.S. Obama administration has sent a number of very clear signals to China that the U.S. would be involved in any armed conflict around the Senkaku.
Still, Cabestan says it is hard to predict whether China may ultimately take inspiration from what Russia did in Crimea. When it comes to the dispute over uninhabited islands in the East China Sea, known as the Senkakus in Japan and Diaoyu Islands in China, Beijing's options are limited. Japan controls the islands, and attempts to even land on them in the past by Chinese activists have not lasted long. Xie Tao, a political scientist at Beijing Foreign Studies University, says if the Chinese government was to support some sort of effort by fishermen or others to land on the islands for a period of time and then proclaim sovereignty, that could backfire.
Everybody knows that it cannot sustain any long-term human settlement. And if you do that, that's obviously a trap set by the Chinese government. And that will only incur international condemnation and international criticism.
The United States says it does not take sides in the disputes, be it in the East or South China Sea. But Washington's efforts to rebalance its position in the region by shoring up diplomatic, economic, political, and security ties has raised concerns in China. Some here see that effort, or pivot to Asia as it is called, as an attempt to contain Beijing's rise. They also argue that Washington's actions are emboldening its allies in the region to raise tensions. Just days before President Obama embarks on his trip, Japan announced a decision to expand its military footprint, deploying troops and radar to an island near the disputed area in the East China Sea. China says it is seeking to peacefully resolve its disputes in the region and has accused Japan of hyping regional threats to justify its military expansion. Japan will be the first stop on President Obama's four-nation tour of the region, which includes visits to South Korea and to other Southeast Asian nations that have territorial disputes with China in the South China Sea, the Philippines, and Malaysia. Last year, a government shutdown in Washington forced President Obama to cancel his attendance at the APEC Leaders Summit. Kabistan says this year's trip is part of an effort to pick up from where he left off.
President Obama wants to repair his non-participation to the APEC summit in Indonesia in the fall last year. That created some frustration and unease in Asia, in particular among U.S. allies, because it gave the occasion for China to sort of run the show in place of Obama.
Political scientist Xie Tao says Beijing will be watching closely to see what Mr. Obama does to reassure his allies in the region, whether he plays the role of peacemaker by promoting regional stability or plays up negative perceptions about China.
I would hope that he would do something to assuage China's suspicion that he's not really here to contain China.
One key test of that, Xie adds, will be Mr. Obama's stop in Malaysia. The stop in Malaysia will be the first for a U.S. president in nearly five decades and comes at a time when relations between Kuala Lumpur and Beijing are under tremendous strain following the disappearance of Malaysia Airlines flight MH370. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
South Korea's President Park Geun-hye has criticized the captain and crew of a passenger ferry for abandoning the ship while it sank with hundreds on board, equating their action to murder. The captain and at least six crew members have been arrested. Recovery teams have retrieved dozens of bodies so far, while many remain missing. VOA's Daniel Scharf reports from Jindo.
The death toll from the sunken Sewol passenger ferry rose rapidly Monday as divers were able to move deeper into the capsized ship and recover more bodies. South Korea's President Park Geun-hye, at a morning meeting, had strong words for those in charge of the passenger ferry. South Korea's President Park Geun-hye, at a morning meeting, had strong words for those in charge of the passenger ferry. She says the conduct of the captain and some crew members is unfathomable from the viewpoint of common sense, and it was like an act of murder that cannot and should not be tolerated. The captain failed to follow evacuation orders from the Jindo Vessel Traffic Services Center immediately after the accident, she says. Crew members told the passengers to stay where they were, but then escaped themselves. She says this is legally and ethically unimaginable. The captain, Lee Jun-seok, and several crew members are under arrest and facing charges of negligence and violating maritime law. The ferry sank Wednesday with 476 people on board, most of them high school students on a school trip. Rescue ships saved 179 as the ship went down, but despite fervent attempts, no one has been saved since. Rescue efforts were hampered by strong currents and murky water. Wreckage and debris also prevented divers from entering passenger areas of the ferry until late Saturday. Days of anguish are turning to grief for the hundreds of relatives of victims camped on the floor of Jindo's gymnasium. Kim Hana's brother was on the ferry, one of 338 students and teachers from Danwon High School in Ansan, just south of Seoul. She says she had hope, but now she feels complicated and heavy-hearted. Even though air is being pumped into the ship, she says, any survivors have had no food or water for 6 days. She wonders if her brother can still be alive. It is still not clear what caused the 6,300-ton ship to sink. Survivors reported hearing a loud noise before it began to list, prompting speculation the ferry could have hit a submerged rock. But investigators are also looking into the possibility that cargo, including numerous vehicles, came loose during a sharp turn and threw the ferry off balance. South Korean media reports say investigators are also considering recent repairs to the ship and its structural integrity. President Park on Sunday declared Jindo and Ansan special disaster zones in order to fast-track emergency support. Daniel Scherf, VOA News, Jindo, South Korea.
Donald Rothwell, a professor of international law at Australian National University, tells VOA's Victor Beattie it appears there was confusion in the crucial early hours of the disaster between the ferry crew and South Korean rescue authorities.
A country like Korea would have fairly sophisticated search and rescue maritime capability and response, but the evidence at the moment suggests that there may well have been some failings in that system. And the way in which the maritime safety authorities responded to the mayday request from the crew of the ferry.
When that cruise liner grounded and tilted over off the Italian coast, we had spoken about that issue. Had anything been learned to have prevented this tragedy?
I think there is clear parallels at one level with the Costa Concordia event and the Sewol event. But perhaps of greater relevance is the fact that throughout East Asia and Southeast Asia over the last decade, we've seen a number of maritime disasters involving ferries. And most importantly, in 2013, the International Maritime Organization convened a regional conference in October looking precisely at this issue and reached agreement on a set of mechanisms for countries in East and Southeast Asia to try to respond to this particular issue. And that very much focused on coordination with respect to maritime safety authorities and related maritime authorities in terms of the safety and security of domestic ferries. What I think will now come under the spotlight is how Korea sought to respond to some of those initiatives from October 2013.
Do you think these regional efforts will be accelerated as a result of this tragedy?
Most definitely, because we've seen a significant track record of maritime disasters involving very significant loss of life in ferries throughout East Asia and Southeast Asia. Some of these have been purely domestic events, and the Sewol ferry incident is one occurring entirely within Korean waters. Last year, we had a major ferry disaster also in Hong Kong Harbour. So I expect that this will continue to show the need for reform by local maritime authorities with a very particular focus on these ferry disasters.
Donald Rothwell is a professor of international law at Australian National University. He spoke with VOA's Victor Beattie. Also in Asia, but a different disaster this time as the search for Malaysia's Airlines Flight 370 enters its seventh week. Relatives in Beijing are continuing to demand answers. Shannon Van Zandt reports.
The families of passengers aboard Flight 370 have released questions for authorities searching for the flight. Sarah Bajak, whose boyfriend Philip Wood was on the flight, sent an email to reporters in the name of the United Families of MH370. The letter asked for an independent peer review of the data British satellite company Inmarsat. The company's data and subsequent analysis were used to conclude the flight went down in the South Indian Ocean. The letter also criticized authorities for issuing death certificates before the plane is found and failing to share information with the next of kin before releasing it to the press. An envoy from the Malaysian embassy met with more than 300 family members at a hotel in Beijing on Monday. They say he provided few answers to their questions and want to meet with authorities that can provide technical answers to their questions instead. Steve Wong's mother was a passenger on Flight 370.
We are totally angry about what they've done. You know, it should be a high-level technical team to communicate with us about technical questions.
During the meeting, people shouted questions at the Malaysian envoy, broke down in tears, and paramedics had to treat one woman who had collapsed. Several times throughout the meeting, family members chanted, "Give us our loved ones." Several people, like this family, had questions for the envoy. He said, "My son was on that plane. Other people's sons, wives, and families were on that plane. Many of us believe that our loved ones were alive and are alive, but you haven't been searching in the right place so far. You simply assume that they are no longer with us. We desperately want a technical team to come to Beijing to help us." He said, "All of us have a burning question in our hearts, and this is where our loved ones are. We don't know whether they are alive or dead." The Malaysian envoy Monday said another team of authorities from Kuala Lumpur would travel to Beijing within 24 hours to answer the relatives' questions.
I request the kind cooperation of all the family members We are really trying our best.
Flight 370 disappeared more than 6 weeks ago on the morning of March 8th with 239 people on board. A pull signal that could be from the plane was detected off the western coast of Australia, but a U.S. Navy underwater drone has yet to find any sign of the plane. Shannon Van Sant, Beijing.
This is International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Dave DeForest in Washington.
Hi, this is Larry London. Join me for Border Crossings every weekday at 15 hours Universal Time on VOA Music Mix. Border Crossings is where you decide what we play. It's an hour of your requests, great giveaways, and interviews with music superstars. Tune in to Border Crossings Monday through Friday at 15 hours Universal Time on VOA Music Mix.
The Speaker of Syria's parliament is announcing that a presidential election will be held June 3rd. Incumbent President Bashar al-Assad said he will seek a third term despite the civil war going on in his country. Edward Uranian reports.
The announcement that the Syrian government would go ahead with presidential elections coincided with the sound of warplanes over the capital and violence in and around all five of Syria's major cities. Parliament Speaker Jihad al-Laham made the long-awaited announcement despite skepticism from many that it would be possible to hold an election amid raging battles across much of the country. Laham says in accordance with the Syrian constitution and the 2014 electoral law, he is calling on Syrian citizens, both inside and outside the country, to exercise their right to elect the president of the Syrian Republic. He stresses that those who would like to run for president have until May 1st to present their candidacies to the Supreme Court. Laham's announcement was greeted with rounds of Katyusha rockets fired by rebel fighters outside the capital, Damascus. The Syrian government news agency Sana reported that five people were killed by rocket fire around the parliament building and the health ministry. A spokesman for the Free Syrian Army told Al Arabiya TV that the rocket fire was aimed at the parliament and the nearby Syrian Army Officers Club. He added that it was possible that civilian targets were accidentally hit by the rockets. Syria scholar Joshua Landis, who heads the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma, says the announcement of the election, given the current circumstance, is almost ironic.
We used to laugh at elections won by 99%. Today, you just have to cry. It would be laughable if it weren't so tragic.
A former U.S. ambassador to Syria, Richard Murphy, tells VOA that it is predictable that Bashar al-Assad would present himself as a presidential candidate. And he says it is even more predictable that he will easily win this election. Murphy says that is because the opposition is fragmented and is unlikely to support a single candidate. Plus, with so many Syrians internally displaced or taking refuge in other countries, it will be hard to get an accurate vote count. He adds, the Assads don't lose elections. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The United Nations mission in South Sudan says rebels killed hundreds of civilians in ethnically motivated attacks when they captured the town of Bientou last week. VOA's Margaret Bashir has more from the United Nations.
The UN strongly condemned what it called targeted killings of civilians, which took place along national and ethnic lines. In a statement, the UN mission, known as UNMISS, said more than 200 civilians were reportedly killed and over 400 wounded in the Bentiu Mosque, where they had gone to flee the violence. It said fighters with the rebel force known as the SPLA in opposition separated individuals based on their ethnicities and nationalities, safely escorting some out of the mosque and killing others. Similar attacks were reported at a Catholic church, an evacuated World Food Program compound, and Bentiu Hospital. Sudanese of Darfuri ethnicity were also targeted. The UN also condemned the use of the local radio station by rebels to incite killings and rape. UN peacekeeping spokesman Nick Birnbach told VOA that UNMISS has deployed additional peacekeepers from its 8,000-plus strong force to Bentiu and other locations where attacks have been reported.
But the truth of the matter is that we can't be everywhere at all times. Also, our peacekeepers are focusing on the protection of civilian sites, where we are sheltering thousands and thousands of terrified IDPs who are fleeing the violence and who are depending on us for their security.
Last week, peacekeepers helped get hundreds of civilians in threatened areas in Bentiu and Robkona to their base for protection. The base is now refuge for more than 22,000 people. The UN's Birnbach said there is a vicious cycle of attack and counterattack happening.
Civilians are, as always, bearing the brunt of it. We're doing everything we can to work with local authorities to try to not only investigate but deter. But ultimately, it is the authorities in South Sudan who are going to have to take action to stop this these terrible events from continuing to occur.
Fighting erupted in South Sudan in December as the army of President Salva Kiir and rebels allied with his former vice president Riek Machar began fighting each other. Violence has now displaced more than 1 million South Sudanese from their homes. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
The Nigerian militant sect Boko Haram says it carried out the bombing in the capital Abuja last week that killed at least 71 people. VOA's Ann Look reports from our West Africa Bureau.
In his new video, Boko Haram leader Abubakar Shekau waved a stick and addressed Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan. "You are just too small," he says. "You are just too small for us." Shekau taunted Nigerian authorities who have repeatedly pledged to put down the now five-year-old insurgency in a matter of months. The Nyanya bus station bombing was Boko Haram's first major attack in the capital in 2 years, something analysts say show its capabilities remain intact, despite the almost year-long military offensive against the rebels. Most of Boko Haram's attacks take place in the far northeast. Analysts also say the size and sophistication of the blast suggests the militants have strengthened their connections abroad. Visiting the bomb site last week, President Jonathan tried to downplay the seriousness of the threat. The Boko Haram problem is, quote, temporary, he said. But Nigerians in the most violence-prone areas of the north tell VOA they aren't reassured.
"Honestly, my brother, we are not saving this country. If Abuja could experience than that, any other part of the state is just a child's play to them."
Three northeastern states have been under a state of emergency for almost a year, but the violence has intensified.
"Well, Nigeria is afraid. Nigeria is scared. The security said they are in control. But from the look of things, I doubt if they are."
Amnesty International says 1,500 people have been killed this year in the conflict between Boko Haram insurgents and the Nigerian security forces, more than half of them civilians. Analysts say the military's heavy-handed tactics since the insurgency began in 2009 have alienated the population. Some people living in the northeast say soldiers are overwhelmed and outgunned. Others say that security forces are just dysfunctional.
"Truly, I have a confidence over them, but there are factors has to be addressed. Yes, the cooperation in between the forces. There are a lot of lapses."
The military's credibility took a hit last week when defense headquarters had to retract its claim that all but 8 of the more than 100 schoolgirls kidnapped in Borno State had been freed. Most of the girls are still missing after armed men raided their school last Tuesday. At least 32 girls have escaped on their own. The defense spokesman said the false claim was an honest mistake, but that hasn't stopped the criticism.
"At the end of the day, we discovered that it was all lie. So tell me, how do we trust our security agency?"
A local newspaper columnist called the communications debacle, along with the ease with which the girls appear to have been abducted, a, quote, smoking gun, and proof that authorities are not being honest about the situation in the northeast. The government and security forces say they are doing what they can, but with each new attack, frustration mounts. Ann Look, VOA News, Dakar.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for joining us for International Edition. By the way, you can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website. It's voanews.com. Check it out. Sitting in again today for Susan Yaki, I'm Dave DeForest in Washington. Have a good day.